What is Putin doing with those berries? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Vladimir Putin gets plenty of exposure on Russian state media, but now he's got his own reality show with scenes like the president hiking.
It is so bizarre. It opens with him saying, "What will Putin do with the wild berries?"
Also, the reality show that is China's presence in Africa, massive Chinese investment there, and that means huge debt for African nations.
It's often called China's debt trap diplomacy in Africa.
Plus, it's players versus humidity at the U.S. Tennis Open.
I don't think we've ever invoked the extreme heat policy in our second week before. We did so yesterday, and we have done so again today, this morning. So the conditions are tough.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We deal in reality, so let's start today with a story about reality TV. Russia might have its next star of the genre, and it's none other than President Vladimir Putin. The hour-long show is called Moscow, Kremlin, Putin. It launched on Russian state TV over the weekend, and it's supposed to give viewers a weekly glimpse into the life of Putin. That's a clip from the trailer which shows off Putin's athleticism, his love of hiking through the wilderness, and his love for people in general. Then there's this joke from Putin's press secretary about the president's safety while hiking. If some bears see Putin, they aren't idiots. They will behave themselves properly. Amy Ferris-Rotman is a Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked her what she thought of the first episode.
Well, I must say, as reality TV shows, it's not particularly gripping. There doesn't seem to be much of a narrative. But of course, we have to admit it, most people in the world are interested in Vladimir Putin. And the show promises to show us all sorts of behind-the-scenes footage. Some of it felt like the news and kind of seeing Putin out and about and his activities. But the parts from his holiday, his vacation last month in Siberia, never seen before footage, that was actually pretty fun.
So let me get this straight. There's commentary running while we watch Putin going about his life?
There is indeed some commentary. The commentary is by Vladimir Solovyov, who is one of the chief propagandists, if you can call him that, of the Kremlin state media machine. He's the one who oversees the episode and he narrates part of it with this kind of loud, booming voice. I mean, it is so bizarre. It opens with him saying, "What will Putin do with the wild berries?" And I mean, he's in Siberia. He's all alone. He's picking up these kind of berries. He's foraging for all sorts of things. There are also kind of strange clips when the show interviews the people around him, and they're talking about Putin as if we've never heard of him before. Huh. We also saw clips of his Siberian adventures when he's in the sunshine with the defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, and they're sitting there and Putin says, "Oh, doesn't the sun warm you up well?" And then the defense minister kind of gives this slightly almost nervous laugh. So there are certainly bits of it which are worth watching, which are amusing, put it that way.
How are Russians reacting to this new show?
So, of course, the state media has been all over it and praising it.
Well, they're producing it, aren't they?
Exactly. They are producing it, but the government has claimed, of course, they have absolutely no role in it. We have seen a few comments from some of the independent media. We have a very famous satirist, Viktor Shenderovich, who's also a fierce Putin critic, come out in the New Times magazine and say with very tongue-in-cheek, "Oh, Putin has given us the true gift of nature." So it's been mocked in some circles. But of course, as with everything with Putin, you can't be overly critical.
I'm guessing state media doesn't run focus groups. Do you think Russians want to go this deep into Putin's life, like his berry-picking habits and all that?
You know what? I think a lot do. I think there's just endless interest in Vladimir Putin, especially his so-called personal life. Almost nothing is known about his personal life. At least nothing is published about it. It's a big secret. And even though this holiday, his berry picking and his kind of musings on life out in the wild is fairly staged, it is still, I think, interesting for a lot of Russians to see what he's up to. I do think it's important to stress that the timing of this show came out when his ratings are at their lowest in almost 5 years.
You think there's a bit of public relations going on here as well?
Yes, tens of thousands of Russians have already said they're going to protest Putin's very unpopular pension reform this Sunday. So the fact that this came out exactly 1 week before, making him look extremely good amid all these low ratings, I think it's not just a coincidence.
Amy, would you go so far as to say that this Putin reality show kind of mirrors Soviet era propaganda, like TV programming under Brezhnev in the 70s?
Absolutely. There was someone saying yesterday, also from the independent media, about the personality cult that was achieved under Joseph Stalin. And now it looks like we've properly come full circle, making the leader look invincible, strong, brave, in touch with his people, and a sort of grandfather to all Russians.
Yeah, on the other hand, this is 2018 and people the world over know about TV production values. Could this backfire on Putin and make him look cheesy and out of touch?
It could. It could. I must say that everyone here was quite surprised that this was even being produced. I mean, Putin is also seen as a very serious man. He's a man who only goes on television when he wants to. And this is a departure from the usual way of seeing him. And I'd like to see what happens with it. We'll wait for the next installment next Sunday.
Well, if he's learning from Donald Trump, he's going about it in reverse order, political leader first, reality show second. Do Russians, though, look at Trump and now think that all leaders should have a reality show at some point in their careers?
That might be the case. I think it's interesting that 2 years ago, the leader of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov, actually did have a reality TV show, which was a complete spin-off from Donald Trump's The Apprentice. He completely copied it. And actually, quite surprisingly, that was very well received. I mean, it was mocked, of course, in more liberal circles, but it actually, I think, boosted his popularity in a very genuine way.
As far as Putin's reality show, once again, we're talking about Putin and Russia. What are we missing here? Like, what is the really critically acclaimed TV show that we're not talking about?
Well, there are a couple shows which are going to begin again in a couple weeks' time. There are several versions of The Americans, which the Russians have come up with, which have been enormously successful here. And in a reverse of the actual show, The Americans, they involve American spies who are turned and end up working for the Russians in Russia. Those shows actually have a huge fan base with Russians across the whole spectrum of society, and we'll be seeing fresh installments soon.
Wow. That's what I want to see. I'll take a look at Moscow, Kremlin, Putin, but then I want to watch that Americans thing.
It's brilliant.
Amy Ferris-Rotman, a Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post, speaking with us from Moscow. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you so much.
Don't do it if you want to avoid a bloodbath. That was the word from the UN today as parties in the Syria conflict began an assault on the province of Idlib, just on the border with Turkey. And last night, President Trump tweeted a warning saying an attack on Idlib would be a potential human tragedy. Today, a Kremlin spokesman dismissed Trump's tweet, and the airstrikes began. Russian fighter planes today carried out more than 24 strikes on Idlib. That's according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Perhaps not a surprise. After all, just last week, Syria's foreign minister said the government's priority was to, quote-unquote, liberate Idlib. John Alterman heads the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joins us from Washington. And John, in a war that's dragged on for 7 years, help us understand why the attack on Idlib is such a big deal.
Well, Idlib is where not only people live, but people have fled to. It is the last holdout of a lot of these groups that have been fighting the Assad government. You probably have 30,000 fighters, but you have 1.5 million people who've moved into Idlib, 1.5 million people who've already been in Idlib. So you have 3 million people with 30,000 fighters, and the regime says the way we're going to win is we're just going to crush it, and a lot of innocent people could get killed.
You've long criticized the Trump administration for not having a real plan for Syria. Is your view unchanged after that tweet from President Trump?
To me, honestly, the tweet read as if it were written by staff rather than by the president. The president said Bashar al-Assad must not recklessly attack Idlib. Does that mean there's a non-reckless way to attack Idlib? I'm not really sure. What I wonder is what the president's desired end state is in Syria and how he intends to advance American interests. It seems to me the president's made very clear he doesn't want to get trapped in Syria. He doesn't want the U.S. to linger longer than we should. But I'm not sure I understand what he's trying to do, what he sees the threats to be, and how to increase U.S. leverage in addressing those threats.
So, I mean, What do you make of this positioning by Trump, regardless of who wrote this tweet? And did you find the language unusual for him?
It felt unemotional compared to the things that he seems to care about. It seemed to be a policy statement. But again, what does he really want the U.S. to do in Syria? What is he afraid about in Syria? What did he discuss in Helsinki with President Putin? What does that matter for the future of Syria? I'm still a little bit unclear what this is all part of. The fact that there was an assault coming on Idlib in the fall was obvious to everybody. Mm. What the United States is going to do about it is not obvious to anybody.
Is the best case scenario for Idlib, like rebels getting pushed out quickly with minimal loss of civilian life, and that brings to an end the war in Syria?
I'm not sure how you can surgically withdraw the rebels that are a jihadi problem for everybody. I mean, the ISIS folks don't wear uniforms that say we're ISIS, and it's hard to distinguish them from other refugees. I think the question is, can you create a circumstance where you have growing security for everybody and some accommodation, reconciliation with the idea that some people are going to fight to the death? That is going to happen. But if you have an area with 3 million people, you don't want to have a civilian population caught in the midst of that. A lot of Mosul was destroyed. This could be an even larger and bloodier scenario, especially because I think you're not going to see the same restraint to the extent you can use the word restraint applied by the Iraqi government as you're going to see with the Syrian government. The way they have fought is with severe indifference to human life. Mm.
So many of the rebels that Assad is aiming to push out or kill in Idlib, they're rooted in the 2011 protests for democracy in Syria. That goes back to the Arab Spring, am I right? And so liberating Idlib is also the end of really the protest to unseat Assad.
It's hard to understand exactly where the pro-democracy people from 2011 fit into the current battle. And certainly some people went from peaceful resistance to armed resistance. You also had a history in Syria facilitated by the Assad government that they developed ties with jihadis, sent them across the border into Iraq to attack Americans. And the idea from the Assad perspective is this is great because we export our domestic jihadi problem and they kill Americans. And if the Americans want anything from us, then they can go make a deal for us to stem the stream of terrorists leaving Syria. And President Assad told me that personally.
Really?
That if the United States wants Syria to stop the flow, they have to give Syria something. So there is partly a long simmering jihadi problem in Syria that existed long before 2011. And that's part of who the fighters are. And then some of the fighters are people who have felt marginalized and are angry and are trying to have a new government.
I got to say, that is an extraordinary admission from Assad, what he told you, and I hadn't heard that before. What was Washington's reaction to that? Because it kind of sounds like blackmail.
Well, it was.
So you had this conversation with Assad like pre-2014.
I think 2007. It was 2007.
Yeah. Okay.
And he was looking for ways to create problems which create leverage for him to get things from the United States. That was his approach.
John, what do you think is going to happen in Idlib?
I'm afraid that there's going to be a tremendous loss of life. The government will be left standing on top of the rubble, and the world will wonder how we begin to solve the problems of Syria, but not have much impetus to solve the problems of Syria. And therefore, I'm afraid that the problems of Syria are going to haunt us long after the ghosts of Idlib haunt us.
John Alterman heads the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up on the show, is it too hot for tennis? This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Maybe you caught the stunning upset in the world of tennis last night. Maybe not. It ended at 1 a.m. Roger Federer, ranked number 2 in the world in men's tennis, was defeated by an unseeded Australian, John Millman. After the match, a reporter asked Federer about what had happened to him on the court. Federer kind of stammered as he started to explain it.
I just thought it was very hot tonight. And it was just one of those nights where I guess I felt I couldn't get air. You know, there was no circulation at all. And yeah, it's uncomfortable. And clearly, just keep on sweating more and more and more as the match goes on. And, you know, you lose energy as it goes by.
At one time, people might have said that Federer was making excuses, but let's be real here. More and more, sporting events are being affected by rising temperatures linked to climate change. Chris Widmeyer is with the U.S. Tennis Association, and he joins us from Flushing Meadows. So how unprecedented is this heat for the U.S. Open?
Well, I mean, it's rather warm and toasty here in New York. I don't think we've ever invoked the extreme heat policy in our second week before. We did so yesterday, and we have done so again today, this morning. So the conditions are tough.
What is the extreme heat policy?
Basically, what happens is that there's a certain reading on the wet bulb, which is a series of climate readings, that supersedes 30.1, the extreme heat policy goes into effect for both the women's and the juniors. So a player is offered the right to take a 10-minute additional break after the second set to cool down, to ice down, or whatever it is they need. The conditions were so extreme that we instituted that policy for the men for the first time early last week.
So as you may know, the dates of the 2022 World Cup of soccer in Qatar, very hot Qatar, has been moved to get out of the summer dates. Is there any talk about doing the same thing with the U.S. Open, like finding a different part of the year to host it?
No, there's been no discussion of that.
What would take a discussion of that kind?
Well, I mean, that's a broader question that would involve the entire global tennis calendar. To move something as monumental as the U.S. Open would require quite a bit of puzzle solving, discussions, etc., because you would be impacting so many dominoes here.
Tell me, how does heat affect how the game is played?
You could look at a number of different factors. How does it affect the player physically? How much humidity is in the air that might actually slow down the pace of the ball? How does it affect the courts, if at all? So, you know, there's a variety of factors, some greater than others, that will go into it. Certainly the number one thing is the fitness level and the ability of a player to adjust to the conditions. And I'm going to say this, I mean, they've been tough conditions.
Chris Widmeyer with the U.S. Tennis Association speaking with us from Flushing Meadows in Queens at the U.S. Open. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
I can remember when Chinese investment in Africa seemed to be mostly benevolent. During the Cold War, the staunchly communist government in Beijing built sugar processing plants in Africa. China also gifted parliament buildings to African governments. The aim was to win hearts and minds. To riff on Seinfeld, China wanted to be there for Africa. These days, China is just there. That's the background for the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation that wrapped up today in Beijing. Leaders from nearly every African country went to the Chinese capital to discuss Chinese investment back home. China's President Xi Jinping pledged an extra $60 billion for infrastructure projects on the continent, and that is well above what was promised the last time the Forum convened in South Africa in 2015. The BBC's Africa business editor, Larry Madowo, is in Nairobi. He says there's concern here in the U.S. about China's growing investment in Africa.
The reason why there's a lot of concern in the U.S. and elsewhere is about the level of indebtedness that Africa is falling into, to China specifically. It's often called China's debt trap diplomacy in Africa. And what China has done is aggressively give out loans to African countries, often loans that these countries cannot afford to pay off. The International Monetary Fund has warned that 40% of low-income countries in Africa risk debt distress or are already in debt distress, and that's where we are.
Wow, that's extraordinary. And then I read that China is now the single largest bilateral financier of all infrastructure in Africa, surpassing like the European Commission and the World Bank and all the G8 countries combined.
China is certainly very active in infrastructure financing, giving out more money than all those other bilateral organizations. And it looks like it's not about to stop anytime soon. The reason why China does this is part of it, it looks good for the African countries. It creates jobs. It creates a lot of jobs, thousands of jobs, when you're building a railway or a port or an airport or a free trade zone for a continent that is struggling with the rampant unemployment. This is very useful. And there's a certain appreciation from the West, Marco, that This is necessary for Africa. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, who was in Africa last week, said every conversation she has with every African leader, they all say they want to create more jobs. And that is why it is her ambition that the UK should be the number one G7 investor in Africa by 2022. But China is not waiting.
So is this indebtedness just a concern for economists who look at the numbers on paper? Like, how worried are African leaders who actually make the policy that seems to be driving their economies into debt with China?
African leaders don't appear to be that worried about the level of indebtedness to China, Marco, because at the closing of the summit today, we heard from President Macky Sall of Senegal, who is the new co-chair of the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, and he said, we're not worried about those criticizing us and our deals with China because these are important for our people. The president of South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa, whose economy has just got into recession, by the way, but he's been out in China really buddying it up with President Xi Jinping and everybody there and hoping that he can get something back for South Africa.
I mean, African nations didn't seem too worried about debt in the 1980s. And then there was that massive campaign that began in the late 90s and continued into the 2000s for debt forgiveness among many African nations, Western nations wiping the debt slates clean and starting from zero. I mean, if the debt to China got too burdensome, is that where this could be headed?
Marco, there are many on the continent who now fear that we might be looking at a deja vu of sorts. They're raising the alarm right now saying we need to put a stop to this. You need to pause and look at what you're getting into. The president of the African Development Bank has told us at the BBC that he sees a major asymmetry of power in the negotiations for these deals between African countries and China. The negotiators from China know that, and they often take advantage of it.
How do African economists see the American concern about African debt to China? Is it like economic envy? Is it true concern about debt, or maybe a consequence of the U.S. under Trump letting China fill the leadership void?
So, Marco, one of the most interesting things to come out of that was the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He thinks most of the criticism from the West, not all, but most of it, is sour grapes from the West. They just don't have as much money to give out to Africa and to the rest of the world like they used to. However, it seems to be a major concern. I remember when Rex Tillerson came to Africa shortly before he was let go, and he specifically targeted China and had some strong criticism for the way China does business here. But it didn't seem to be getting across, really, to the African leaders he was meeting. A lot of them will go out of their way to defend China because they have seen how it works for them. It helps keep the people happy because they see new roads and new airports and they see the jobs that are coming with it.
Larry Mado, the business editor with our partners at the BBC, speaking with us from Nairobi. Thanks very much, Larry.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman. A graduate student from Pakistan is back in the U.S. for the new school year. She was uneasy about returning this year after her cousin was killed in a school shooting in Texas.
If I did not come back to the U.S., I would always have a sense of an unfinished chapter.
And now she's speaking out about what happened. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It is back to school time here in America, and of course that goes for international students too, who are starting classes at U.S. high schools and universities. For many of them, a place in an American classroom could lead to a well-paying job. But what happens when the U.S. doesn't feel safe? Reporter Jesse Hardman spent some time with a graduate student from Pakistan who was personally affected by the tragedy of a U.S. school shooting.
Hey, hey! Ho, ho!
The NRA has got to go! Hey, hey!
There's been a lot of marches this year pushing for stricter gun laws. At a recent rally in front of the NRA headquarters in Virginia, a new voice emerged.
Dear NRA leaders, do you know how it feels when you receive a phone call from Pakistan? Shahira, there's been a shooting at Sabika School.
That's Shahira Jaleel Albasit, a grad student in Washington, D.C., in front of the crowd. She's clutching a photo of her 16-year-old cousin.
What you hear next literally rips life from under your feet.
Jaleel Albasit is talking about a phone call she got in May from her family in Pakistan. Her cousin, Sabika Sheikh, was gunned down at school by a fellow student in Santa Fe, Texas, just outside Houston. 9 other people died, too. Jaleel Albasit remembers encouraging her cousin to apply for an exchange program for students from Muslim-majority countries.
I do remember very, very clearly that day and the place at her home
when I went in, I said that you need to apply and I do not want to talk to you the next time and you telling me that you've not done that.
Sabika Sheikh was a high schooler in Karachi. She wanted to join the Foreign Service and saw studying in the U.S. as a first step. In a video she posted online, Sheikh talked about her excitement over getting into the exchange program. It's a homemade video, so the audio's a bit rough.
I was like over the moon. I wrote a diary entry that day because it was really special for me. And seeing those.
When she got to Texas, Sheikh posted pictures with her new friends, showing them how to wear hijab. Then, on May 18th, just weeks before heading back to Pakistan, the school shooting happened, and Sheikh was gone. After attending her cousin's funeral in Karachi, Shahira Jalil Albasit had tough conversations with her family about being safe in the U.S. and their fear of gun violence. But she felt compelled to return.
If I did not come back to the U.S., I would always have a sense of an unfinished chapter. I think the center of what happened with her and the center of this conversation is located in the U.S.
Jalil Albasit's back now and busy. She wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post and is researching the gun reform movement as part of her Fulbright scholarship program. But she says she can also feel unsafe. On one of our calls, she was walking through campus and told me how she's extra vigilant now.
We're walking through the 8th Street, right at the center of the George Washington University. A lot of people going across from all different sides. This is one sample of a place where I feel a sense of vulnerability.
It's so sad. So sad.
Hearing how fearful Jalil Albasit feels at school pains Ann Kerr Adams, who works at UCLA's International Institute. Kerr Adams organizes seminars and events to make foreign scholars like Jalil Albasit feel at home in the U.S., despite travel bans and safety concerns.
We're in a down period right now, internationally speaking, pulling in instead of reaching out.
Kerr Adams' own travels are displayed in her office at UCLA, including a photo of her meeting Yasser Arafat in Tunisia.
That was in 1983.
Kerr Adams shares Jalil Albasit's experience of losing a loved one in a foreign country. Her husband, Malcolm Kerr, ran the American University of Beirut when he was assassinated in 1984 during civil war in Lebanon.
Lots of people ask me why I go back to the Middle East, and I said, well, it wasn't people I know who killed my husband.
Kerr Adams hopes Jalil Albasit can find a way to turn her pain into impact. Jalil Albasit says that's the plan.
I'm here to mobilize the rest of my time here for Sabika and for this conversation, for this movement, for whatever I can do about it.
The more she gets a grip on the gun debate, Jalil Albasit thinks the U.S., which has a terrorism travel warning for her country, Pakistan, needs to reconsider how it uses the word terrorism in light of its own struggle with gun violence. She says terrorism can't just be defined by politics.
For me, growing up in Pakistan, I think we came to define terrorism not really essentially by which group claimed responsibility for an attack and what were their motives. I think it essentially came down to how we felt.
And this definition of terrorism fits what happened to her cousin, says Jalil Albasit.
What Sabika felt in that moment was terror.
After graduating next year, she plans to return to Pakistan and work with young people on building peace in the name of her cousin, Sabika Sheikh. For The World, I'm Jesse Hardman.
Like Osama bin Laden, the U.S. has had a very mixed view of Jalaluddin Haqqani, the Afghan warlord. At one time, he was a pious freedom fighter, later a terrorist enemy. During the Reagan era, when the Soviets occupied Afghanistan, the U.S. government saw Haqqani as an ally it could work with. But since 2001, the Haqqani network has been a friend of the Taliban and one of the most ruthless enemies of American military forces in the region. The Taliban now say that Haqqani is dead after a long illness. Majid Mashal is Kabul correspondent for the New York Times. I've heard a lot of Afghans say Haqqani has been dead for years, Majid. Should we be more certain now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think because the Taliban confirmed it, we had reported in 2015 that he was likely dead. There was consensus that he had been ill for years, for the past 10 years or so. So he was just a symbolic figure already.
Who was Jalaluddin Haqqani and how did he rise to prominence?
So he was educated in a religious madrasa in Pakistan, but he came from the tribal areas that sort of straddle Afghanistan and Pakistan. His family had a lot of land, but also he established and developed a network of sort of the smuggling routes and things like that. But when in the 80s, 70s and 80s, he started getting involved in the guerrilla warfare against the Soviet-backed communist regime at the time. And that was when the American administration decided that Afghanistan would be the front line to try to stop and defeat the expansion of communism. And they funneled a lot of money through the Pakistani intelligence agency as this middleman into these guerrilla leaders in Afghanistan. And Jalaluddin became one of those main guerrilla leaders because he already had a decent network in the south, southeast, that he could sort of bring arms into Afghanistan. He could bring fighters. And that included a lot of the Arab fighters at the time. You know, Osama bin Laden was an American ally at the time. And Jalaluddin was one of the people who played host to those Arab fighters.
And since 2001, what has Haqqani been doing?
So he was a major part of this Taliban resurgence in mid-2000s. Initially, he kept his autonomy, that he was aligned with the Taliban, but he wasn't necessarily part of their central leadership. He was doing his own things on behalf of the Taliban. And then he became known for these really ruthless, well-trained, sophisticated groups of attackers that would target urban centers, that they would take over a building, they would fight for hours, and they would grab all the headlines, maybe they would kill some people, but they would basically, you know, shut down a major city like Kabul as all the TV cameras focused on these guys, you know, taking over a hotel or something. So his network got known for that kind of very attention-grabbing attacks. In more recent years, as Jalaluddin sort of became sick and he got old, he sort of passed the baton to his son, Sirajuddin, who is in his early to mid-40s. And Sirajuddin kind of made the Haqqani network a more integrated part of the main Taliban insurgency, so much so that he is the deputy leader of the Taliban. And wow. increasingly, he is the de facto sort of military decision maker for the Taliban.
Jalaluddin Haqqani is the man credited with bringing suicide bombing to Afghanistan. And now it's said he's died, an old man, after an illness. How do Afghans feel generally about him?
Well, his name is entirely associated with some of the most deadly attacks, particularly attacks that caught the attention of a nation. So definitely there's a sense of relief in that. But at the same time, there's an understanding that he was an old man and his tactics, sadly, are well entrenched, and that his son has shown over the past few years that he's been sort of in control, that he will continue. There's another element to this, that a lot of these urban attacks that used to be claimed by the Haqqanis in more recent years have been claimed by the Islamic State. So when you talk to Afghan officials, when you talk to Western officials, some of them say actually there's an overlap between the facilitating networks that work for the Haqqanis and that work for the Islamic State. So yes, Jalaluddin is gone, but the tactic of suicide bombing and sophisticated attacks are well entrenched.
Majid Mashal of the New York Times on the line with us from Kabul. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
We'll go to Afghanistan for some different stories next week on The World. Shirin Jafari here in our Boston newsroom traveled to Kabul recently. She brought back stories of Afghan women who are doing more than just surviving. Kabul is now a place where there are growing numbers of women going to university, owning businesses, determined to create opportunity in a country still racked by war. But as for so many women worldwide, there is risk in just being a woman.
So this is the biggest maternity hospital in Afghanistan.
Risks like having a baby. Shirin spent a day with one of the country's most respected midwives getting a tour of this busy maternity ward.
So where we
you're standing is near to surgery ward.
Well-managed midwifery is a big step forward. Afghanistan has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world. And for this midwife, it is a world away for her compared to how things were under Taliban rule.
This is the happiest time of my life when I help a woman to have a safe delivery and to have her baby happy and healthy, smiling.
The growing number of midwives in Afghanistan, that's one of the stories coming up next week in our series devoted to Afghan women. The Afghanistan you aren't hearing about, all next week here on The World. In Germany, the city of Chemnitz has been in the news lately. We've talked recently on the show about the anti-immigrant demonstrations there in recent days, supported by far-right extremists. They were sparked by a fatal stabbing, followed by the arrest of two suspects, originally from Syria and Iraq. Last night, there was a big reaction to those anti-immigrant demos. Tens of thousands of people showed up in Chemnitz for a free concert. They were chanting, "Nazis out." And they used the hashtag, "There are more of us," a response to the right-wing slogan, "We are the people." This concertgoer said the message is that politicians should pay attention to what people there are saying. It is a good thing, this woman said, that everybody came out to protest against racism. In response to recent events in Germany, a new political campaign is getting off the ground. It's aimed at attracting people worried about the rise of the anti-immigrant far right. It's called Aufstehen, which means stand up. The founder is Sarah Wagenknecht. She's one of the leaders of the left party in parliament. And she says that the current wave of hatred and intolerance is not addressed. Germany could be unrecognizable in 5 to 10 years. She makes the point that many people who support the far right have been left behind economically.
In einem Land, wo trotz jahrelangem Wirtschaftsaufschwung knapp die Hälfte der Bevölkerung, also 40%,
she says, in a country where close to half the population, 40%, hasn't seen a real wage increase for 20 years, despite an economic recovery, democracy isn't working anymore. In eastern Germany, left-wing parties have been losing ground to the anti-immigrant AfD, which is now the third largest party in Germany. Joseph Jannings is with a Berlin-based think tank called the European Council on Foreign Relations, and he says the far-right movement is part of a political realignment in Europe.
It is one more factor contributing to the erosion of the political center. And that, I think, will have far-reaching consequences over the long term, because in Germany, but also in a number of other European countries, we're used to have centrist parties with a rather broad electoral base that would then reach out to more particularist, smaller parties to build majority coalitions. Now that the centers are eroding and the centrist parties are eroding, this is becoming far more complicated.
It's not clear how much support the Aufstehen campaign might attract, but many Germans are skeptical. A recent survey found that just 20% of those polled believe that the new campaign would succeed in the long term. Bird strikes. Birds colliding with planes or plane engines. This is a serious problem around the globe. Occasionally, bird strikes can even bring down a jet. Remember that U.S. Airways flight that had to make an emergency landing in the Hudson River? At the airport just outside Quito, Ecuador, there's a woman whose job it is to protect the traveling public by scaring small birds away from the area. Her employees? Birds of prey. Reporter Clayton Kahn went to meet her for the BBC show Outlook.
Her name is Ruth Muñiz, and she takes me to three large sheds some 800 meters from the runway, where her trusty employees, several falcons, eagles, owls, and vultures, call home.
At first, the whole airport staff was always visiting here because all of a sudden, there was a kind of zoo at the airport. People really didn't understand the project very well. We began with 6 birds, 4 eagles, and 2 falcons, and I had to basically live here for 4 months because there was really no one around trained to do this. No one knew anything about falconry.
Every day, Ruth's motley crew of raptors carry out multiple patrols to scare off those doves and ducks that pose a serious risk to hundreds of incoming and outgoing flights. And she proudly tells me that her feather discipline team is made up of orphaned, abused, and rehabbed birds. I wanted to know, how did this Spanish woman end up in charge of a very peculiar branch of airport security at Ecuador's busiest hub? It all began back in Ruth's late teenage years, when she witnessed a falconry show for the first time back home in Spain in the 1990s.
There was a flight demonstration of trained raptors, and I just couldn't understand it at all. It didn't fit in my head. How could these free-flying birds take off and return to humans? It went against everything I understood about wild animals and their relationship to humans. They usually run away from us.
At that moment, Ruth discovered her passion, and she began falconry training at that same bird center.
Obviously, as a newbie, I committed many errors, and there was one bird that was particularly aggressive or was a bit manic depending on the person it was interacting with. One time, when I was flying this eagle, she decided that she didn't want to return to my hand and instead went straight for my neck. I was bleeding profusely, and I bet people thought that this bird had killed me. But in the end, it was okay.
But did you say, like, okay, I'm done with this? This bird almost took my head off, and I'm finished? I'm going to go work at an ice cream shop or something?
Well, my pride was severely hurt. So what I later did was I worked specifically with that bird. Her name was Clodovea. In the end, we became friends.
Nos hicimos amigas.
Instead of being traumatized by the violent encounter with Clodovea, Ruth instead wanted to study one of the biggest, strongest, and most elusive birds of prey in the world, the American harpy eagle, a bird that plucks adult sloths from the rainforest canopy.
It is the biggest eagle in the Americas and the most powerful on the planet.
By herself, Ruth decided to venture out into the dense Amazon rainforest of Ecuador, one of the habitats of the harpy eagle.
A small plane flew me to the area, dropped me off, and left. I was alone. I vividly remember the pilot telling me that he had no idea how I was going to return because no planes fly out that way. I didn't really understand if planes would regularly fly to the area. I didn't know how the communication was going to be, and I ended up being out there for a year before the next plane would come.
But Ruth was not completely alone. She found herself in a small indigenous village in the middle of the rainforest.
There were four families, and you were noticed.
She adapted to the rustic lifestyle, built a close friendship with the locals, and was entirely fixated on finding the flying predator that can stand nearly a meter tall and have a wingspan of nearly 2.5 meters wide.
But in the first whole year, I never saw one. The locals used to joke with me, saying, "Oh, look, there's a harpy," but it would be a parrot. They'd laugh, and I wouldn't pay attention. But there was this moment. We were in a huge downpour out in the canoe. We were soaked. And someone said, "Look, isn't that a harpy?" And I said, "Yes, yes, I could see it out there. There was a harpy eagle. It was a male trying to protect itself from the rain. I couldn't believe it."
How did you feel when you finally found the nest?
Of course. We spent 20 days trying to capture the bird without luck. Finally, the locals, Cofan indigenous people, told me that we will never capture the animal until we ask permission. They believe in a Goro spirit who takes care of the harpy eagles. And if you don't ask for permission and you don't explain to this spirit what you plan to do, then the spirit will never leave you alone. It will haunt you. Finally fatigued and sort of apathetically, I agreed to the Cofan's request, and we asked for permission. The very next day in the morning, we captured the eagle. I thought, what a coincidence, or how strange. But the Cofans thought it was the most natural thing in the world. They said, of course, permission was finally asked for. It was explained why she wants to put a kind of backpack on the bird to track it, what she plans to do with it, so there's no problem.
A plane would eventually pluck Ruth out of the jungle, and she would go on to finish her academic work studying the bird. Now, she's a top expert in the harpy eagle and has gained a reputation around Ecuador as being the eagle whisperer. So when plans were being drawn up to open the new airport in Quito, Ruth was invited to implement the novel bird security.
So right now I'm looking at an owl, which is part of the team of raptors and birds of prey that go off and save airplanes. And this particular owl looks like a little fuzzball that is very talkative.
And although her job ultimately at the airport is to help guarantee flight and passenger safety, Ruth admits that her true motivation is to defend and protect her wing colleagues.
Birds of prey here in Ecuador are like a symbol of the wild, of the unknown, of being misunderstood. They are animals that are killed, that are treated aggressively. People think they are out to harm us, attack us, that they will steal your food, or that owls are witches. So when you are able to change those perceptions, this group of animals is finally understood.
Ruth Muñiz and her skilled birds of prey at the Quito airport. Ending that story from reporter Clayton Kahn in Ecuador. It also brings us to the end of this edition of The World from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.